This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Kelly Ayotte struggles to ride out a viral moment from a televised debate. She was asked if Donald Trump is a good role model for children.
I think that certainly there are many role models that we have, and I believe he can serve as president, and so absolutely, I would do that.
And Donald Trump returned to New Hampshire for an invitation-only event in Sandown and promised to bring manufacturing back.
I want to see the day when Apple will make their iPhones in this country instead of making them in China and Vietnam and all over the place, okay?
Candidates for governor also debated this week, clashing on Medicaid, Planned Parenthood, and their business records. And will New Hampshire's drought ever end? Officials are worried. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Give us a call. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests this week are Allie Morris, reporter for the Concord Monitor, Trent Spinner, editor of the Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar at Southern New Hampshire University and founder of the blog New Hampshire Political Capital. All right, let's start with Donald Trump's visit to Sandown last night. I was there, hadn't been to Sandown in a while, I confess. And, well, I have to say the event raised plenty of questions. Was Donald Trump preparing for Sunday's debate? Was taking pre-screened questions a good way to do so? Was he desecrating New Hampshire's tradition of town hall meetings? Allie, you were there. What did you think?
Well, it certainly was a picturesque location for a town hall. I think it's sort of what we think of. Sandown is a tiny town. There's about 6,000 people who live here. It was in the historic town hall building, which, you know, is wood paneled, very nicely restored, I might add.
I think I agree.
But it definitely did not have the vibe of a traditional town hall. It had a moderator, Howie Card, who's a conservative radio host and Trump supporter, asked questions that had been submitted ahead of time by audience members. They had to be written out on cards. The audience was invite only. There were about 150 people there, many of whom were already Trump supporters. And Trump took about a dozen questions in 30 minutes. He was separated from the crowd by a red velvet rope line. And then he left afterwards without doing too much handshaking. So I think when people think of a traditional town hall, it's voters asking the candidate questions themselves, really pressing them for answers. And that wasn't really the format here. The next debate on Sunday is going to have a town hall vibe. There will be moderators, but people in the audience will be able to ask questions. But I don't think the questions will be as friendly as what we heard last night.
No, probably not. It was interesting to watch New Jersey Governor Chris Christie was there. And during some of what Trump was talking, I was like watching his facial expressions. You know, he obviously takes great pride in his ability to perform in a town hall setting. And this was obviously not the set of town hall he favors and the kind of thing that he would deride another candidate for doing. And there were tweets and emails coming in from John Kasich supporters, you know, mocking Trump. You know, Trent, do you think that this sort of thing makes any difference at this point?
I don't. And I think that the town hall format after the primary, there's not much history there. You know, candidates, including Chris Christie, fun fact, by the way, this was, I think Sandown was the first place where he had a town hall meeting. So it was interesting to see him back here with Trump in Sandown. But you know, there's not much history of candidates doing town halls after the primary. Chris Christie, John McCain, all kinds of different people did tons of town halls in New Hampshire leading up to the primary. And that's kind of the idea, right, is that during the primary you get kind of a closer interaction with people. But you have to realize now Trump has a national media a contingent following him. He has Secret Service protection. It's not quite as logistically easy to do this now.
I mean, it was interesting to see Trump in a small room. I mean, the Sandown Town Hall, as Allie mentioned, is a lot smaller than a typical venue for Trump. And, you know, these were loyalists in the room with him. But, you know, you get in a small room with Trump and people who really support him, and you definitely see a warmth between them and a candidate, the candidate that doesn't, you know, isn't conveyed at a, you know, stadium-sized rallies. You know, it was interesting. There was a clock on the floor. You know, it was going to toll the 2 minutes to remind him, which, you know, was part of the reason why people were saying this was preparation for Sunday's town hall debate in St. Louis. Why don't we hear what Donald Trump actually said on that score?
They said, Donald Trump is going to New Hampshire to practice for Sunday. This has nothing to do with Sunday. And it's like they make you into like a child. And this has I love the people of New Hampshire. This was set up a little while ago. They were going to cancel it. And I said, why are you going to cancel it? Well, you want a debate prep. I said, forget debate prep. I mean, give me a break. Do you really think that Hillary Clinton is debate prepping for 3 or 4 days? Hillary Clinton is resting, okay? She's resting. She wants to build up her energy for Sunday night. And you know what? That's fine. But the narrative is so foolish. I'm here for one reason. I love the people of New Hampshire. I said I was going to be here, and I'm here. Very simple.
That was Donald Trump last night in Sandown. He loves the people of New Hampshire. That's why he was here. Wasn't debate prep, Dean. You know, do you buy I'm not preparing for a debate?
It's hard to know where the truth lies in all of this in terms of the extent to which this was set up in advance. Howie Carr said yesterday that he was contacted with very short notice to fill in as a host. So I don't know how much in advance this was actually scheduled. Maybe they had some other type of form scheduled in advance. I don't know. He's under tremendous pressure for this town hall meeting at Washington University in St. Louis on Sunday. Tremendous expectations. There's been this sort of drip, drip, drip in the press of GOP officials and politicians who are saying that if he doesn't get his act together for this particular event, they're going to start bailing on him and focus on their own political fortune. So it's going to be a much more pressurized environment. It's probably going to be larger. It's going to be more adversarial. He's got to go 90 minutes. And if you remember that last debate, he sort of lost steam in the last 45 minutes to half hour, which is kind of ironic given that he always criticizes Hillary Clinton, as we heard about her endurance. So he needs to keep it going for 90 minutes. He hasn't had a lot of experience in this. They had the Commander-in-Chief Forum last month in which he had 30 minutes in front of an audience. But he's going to have to show an ability to connect with voters. And even voters who, for whom they may not be his first choice. Whereas in this event last night, as you said, there's kind of a warmth in the room. There was clearly his handpicked. It was invitation-only supporters. It's going to be a very different vibe at Wash U. So we'll see. There's a lot riding on this. We know he doesn't like to do debate prep. It's really unclear to me. I think that there's some pressure on him to at least get him into a format in which he's engaging people individually rather than talking to a large, several thousand person rally.
Trent?
I've been hearing for a while that he was trying to come back this week. I'd heard from several different larger political venues in the state saying
to do some sort of town hall
right.
style.
Right. So I think that Trump is telling the truth when he says this wasn't kind of a last minute thing and that they had that this was on the books.
But the format may have been a last minute
exactly.
change.
Exactly. But that's the thing is that the
format. Because Carr said he was just contacted.
Exactly. So I think they wanted to come back to New Hampshire, and also to Trump's point that he feels like the media is not portraying him accurately. We talked to our reporter who was there yesterday. Talked to some people who said, you know what, I wanted to come to this because everything is so filtered. I see sound bites on social media. I see sound bites on TV. And I want to come see him in a small venue and decide for myself whether or not I'm going to vote for him. So I think there are still some people out there like that. I do think that he wanted to come to New Hampshire. I don't know what if this was debate prep or wasn't debate prep. I think at the end of the day, that one specific point doesn't matter. It was interesting to see him talk about it.
Well, the questions that he asked, I mean, there were some that were reasonably substantive, but some were, you know, did you hold back in the first debate? How will you be a successful person? Follow your passion, says Donald Trump. You know, do you have a childhood memory that stuck with you and why? So it was certainly not the sort of thing you typically get at a town hall meeting, Alan.
Well, and I just think, to Trent's point, I think it's interesting to compare Trump's campaign strategy with that of Hillary Clinton. You know, she's obviously been making a push recently to try to get young voters, you know, a group that hasn't really warmed to her yet by bringing up Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And I think it's interesting, you know, obviously Donald Trump needs to kind of woo over skeptics and independent voters. And when you have an invite-only crowd made up mostly of already supporters, I just sort of wonder what he is what types of votes he's trying to gain with this type of town hall.
Well, there was one question that was asked by Sharon Osbourne, whose husband is in the legislature, and she's a Republican activist who was supportive originally of Rand Paul of Kentucky. And she asked a question essentially, what would you say to conservatives who still don't really know where you are and may not trust you, basically? And that's a paraphrase. And, you know, Trump's answer was essentially, there are not many of them left. And, you know, Governor Sununu now supports me. And, you know, he went after me hard. I think he said he really hunted Trump during the primary. And, you know, he's a great guy. And, you know, Governor Sununu and Donald Trump obviously, you know, traded a number of insults during the primary. But after the event she was leaving, I talked to Sharon Osbourne and I said, well, you know, what did you make of what he said? And she said, well, you know, he didn't really, you know, answer the question in the way I hoped, which was, you know, these are my principles, these are my beliefs, but, you know, I'm feeling reasonably good about, you know, what he said in toto. And you know, last night you certainly heard there were a number of people there who weren't card carrying Trump supporters from the get go, who are now, you know, fairly comfortable with him. And I guess we'll see, you know, how that translates to all the people who didn't vote for him.
Well, I think that's a great point, because what I've been hearing privately from a lot of Republicans, even high-ranking Republicans, is that they're going to vote for Kristi Noem, they're going to vote for Kelly Ayotte, and they're going to vote for Hillary Clinton, or they're not comfortable voting for Donald Trump. And no one – I think that's a difficult thing to say, especially if you're a lifelong Republican, to come out and say, look, I'm not voting for the Republican nominee. But if – and I'm sure everyone listening now has a friend who says this. You know, I've been a Republican, but I don't know if I can vote for Donald Trump. So I do think that there are people like that out there. So.
And this is one of the kind of core things we've been trying to get at this cycle, the extent to which the down ballot races, whether it's governor or senator, member of Congress, are going to be detached from that decision over the presidential choice. And, you know, the whole role model flap notwithstanding, it looks like Kelly Ayotte has had some success in detaching herself from Trump, if you look at the polling data over a number of weeks. So what you're suggesting, Trent, kind of feeds into that idea that people are thinking about these New Hampshire races in a somewhat different fashion than they are the choice for president.
All right. Tell us what you think. Join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org. And, Dean, you brought up the role model, so we'll go there. That was, you know, the kind of takeaway from the first televised debate in the U.S. Senate between incumbent Republican Kelly Ayotte and Democratic challenger Governor Maggie Hassan. Allie, you were a panelist in that debate. Did you know at the moment that Kelly Ayotte kind of backed into saying she would absolutely consider Donald Trump a role model, that this would linger the way it seems to be?
To be honest, I was focused on my next question. But yeah, no, you heard it, and I couldn't see either of the candidates' faces from where I was sitting, but looking back in the video footage, you can kind of tell just by the two candidates, obviously the footage is being played over and over, that they knew that something had happened here. And then quite soon after the debate, Democrats took to Twitter. They went on email, really pumping this point up. You know, I think so far in the race, Democrats have had a hard time really pinning Trump on Kelly Ayotte. She said that she supports him but does not endorse him, you know, a line that's really earned a lot of ridicule but has so far allowed her to kind of skirt being tied too much to Trump's policies.
I mean, getting kind of old, frankly. Like, there's only so many times people can go at this, and this certainly provided kind of fresh material.
Yeah, it had definitely faded, I think.
So why don't we listen to the moment from the debate?
The President of the United States is obviously an aspirational figure, one who is our role model and an individual who stands for ideals on a world stage. Would you tell a child to aspire to be like Donald Trump?
I would tell a child to absolutely aspire, certainly to be their best and to be president and to seek to run for the presidency, absolutely.
But would you, again, to the question, would you tell them to be like Donald Trump? Would you point to him as a role model?
I think that certainly there are many role models that we have, and I believe he can serve as president, and so absolutely, I would do that.
All right, that was Kelly Ayotte earlier this week in a debate at New England College sponsored by the Concord Monitor, New England Cable News, WKXL and WGIR. There you have it. Absolutely is a word that we've heard a lot of. And, you know, do you think the damage might have been slightly more contained had she said something even along the lines of, when asked, could he be seen as a role model? Well, you know, sure, he could be seen as a role model. I mean, the absolutely suggests this, you know, sort of total commitment, which clearly isn't there, but it is what she said, Trent.
Yeah, and she later came out and said she misspoke. Look, the question was – the way the question was phrased was pretty difficult. It really allowed her to kind of step in it, which is what happened.
And that was Chris Ryan, by the way, of WKXL asking that question.
So, you know, it was a difficult – the way the question was constructed and the follow-up was difficult to really answer that. And so as you can see, as you can hear from that soundbite, I mean, it's – very strained.
Yeah, she sounds it's almost agonized. You can kind of hear her trying to figure her way through potential thickets. You know what? You know, I'm sure at the moment it was very difficult to figure out how to get through it. But you know what she should have said was, you know, all of our children should aspire to be president, boys and girls. But Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have a lot of baggage. It's a very complicated situation. Let's talk about Ronald Reagan. What a good role model he would be for our children, or you know, whatever other Republican she wanted to highlight. And I just think she just sort of got caught flat-footed because this whole issue, as you were saying, Josh, has kind of faded a little bit in recent months. And this was sort of a whole kind of re-dredging up of that issue.
Well, the interesting – I mean the first thing out of the debate was, you know, kind of boilerplate from the campaign, we won. And then after this moment seemed to pick up steam on social media and after the first
round of
news write-ups of the event that kind of led with this appeared. You know, Ayotte issued her I misspoke, neither Trump nor Hillary Clinton are role model statement. And then – you know, a day later, you know, she was out with a campaign ad. Why don't we listen to this?
Let's be honest. Both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are far from perfect. And I'm not perfect either. But when partisan politicians shut down the government, I led the fight to reopen it. I've worked to find solutions to New Hampshire's heroin epidemic. And I've crossed the aisle to protect New Hampshire's clean air and clean water. I've been called a problem solver by independent groups and ranked as one of the most bipartisan senators. I'm Kelly Ayotte, and I approve this message because whether I'm working with Republicans, Democrats, or independents, I'm standing up for New Hampshire.
Okay, that was an ad Kelly Ayotte released, her campaign released, in the wake of the debate and the role model issue. So good move, Dean, that ad?
Yeah, sure. She had to do something to kind of redirect the conversation. You know, we'll see whether – it's not clear to me whether this is going to have – a dramatic impact on the race. Was it a Suffolk poll that just came out that had her up by 6 points over Maggie Hassan, although I don't know sort of the exact dates of that poll. It may or may not include the Monday night debate. Yeah, she absolutely had to do something. And, you know, I think as I've heard a number of people say, if she had kind of used this approach up front, it would have saved her a lot of trouble. But, you know, sometimes when you're in the middle of a debate like that and you sort of know you're headed in the wrong direction, you just kind of can't quite figure your way out of it. She needed to do something. I think that's just this whole sort of retraction, campaign ad, et cetera, reasonable to do. We know that I think the Hassan folks are going to run an ad next week.
All right. So, Dean, as you were saying, ad running this week, you know, they're obviously – the Hassan campaign is obviously going to ride this as long as possible.
Sure.
And it was interesting. I was at the debate on Wednesday night and watching Democratic Party Chairman Ray Buckley as he came from the room. His eyes were flashing and he was sort of grinning, you know, in a pronounced manner. You know, but so, you know, Democrats obviously view this as a very good thing out of the debate. But, you know, what any other takeaways out of the debate,
There's a reason why this answer was so strained. And it's not because Kelly Ayotte doesn't know how to speak in public. She was a career prosecutor. She was in front of judges and juries all the time. There is a reason, and here's the reason. Somewhere between 35% and 45% of voters in New Hampshire are going to vote for Donald Trump. Kelly Ayotte needs those voters. But 35% or 45% may not be enough to get her over the hump, and she will lose the race if she isn't able to capture some independents, moderate Republicans, even some very moderate Democrats. So what she's trying to do is make sure that she has that support, the Trump support, but that she's also able to get some more support from the middle. So that's been the real challenge of her campaign, is both trying to put together this coalition of enough voters to win, to beat Maggie Hassan.
All right. Why don't we go to the phones for a moment? Ann is on the line from Pembroke.
Thanks for taking my call. I guess what I have seen is that Donald Trump knows what to do in order to go up in the polls. He has to act presidential. He did that. He went up in the polls, and then he turned around and started pulling his same old stuff. So I'm guessing that with the reality that he actually might become president, and then he'd have to divest from all his business interests, I don't think he actually wants to be president. I think maybe he's saying, I'm going to tank this, and I'll just spend the time bashing Hillary.
All right, Ann, thanks. This is something that, you know, I guess I heard more of this sort of talk, you know, some months ago. Obviously, being president is a demanding job, and running for president is, you know, god-awful from observing it up close. But both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are doing it. And so I don't know. I think people at this point, you know, take Donald Trump's aspiration to be president fairly seriously.
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting that the kind of the requirements of sort of, you know, separating yourself from business interests as president is a little more lenient than it is for, I think, any other position in government, cabinet position or anything like that. So, I think he seems to be comfortable with the idea that his children will continue to run it. And I think that's largely the way it is now. He just sort of kind of dips in and out of it. So, you know, but the issue, I think the other interesting issue that Ann raises is this idea that, you know, he needs to be, quote, presidential, and everybody has in their mind their own version of what that means. The challenge for him has been that he sort of seems to be able to do that for a while, and then something trips him up, and then he kind of goes off by reverting to his old behavior. And in this case, it was the Miss Universe controversy and his comments about the pageant winner, and you know, and that combined, I think, with his unhappiness with the negative press over the last debate performance, he just kind of went on a week-long bender almost of insulting people and tweeting late at night, et cetera. And I think that's what gives some people who are on the fence a little bit of concern.
All right, again, thank you for your call, and tell us what you think. Join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. We're talking presidential politics. We're talking senatorial politics. Tell us what's on your mind. Email exchange@nhpr.org. So I want to go back to something Trent was mentioning about Kellyanne's desire to build coalitions, that she wants the Trump support, but she knows she needs more than the Trump support. And, you know, one thing she did this week on that front that was interesting was, doling out free condoms at UNH. You wrote about this, Allie. What should people make of this?
Yeah. The reporting all came off of a tweet which showed a sign with Kelly Ayotte's campaign logo on it saying, use condom sense, free condoms here. And some of her campaign volunteers were handing out free condoms at the University of New Hampshire in Durham. They've been doing it for about a week. And the goal of this effort is to raise awareness for a bill that Senator Ayotte has sponsored that would allow birth control to be made over the counter. And this proposal is actually opposed by Democrats who say it's a way to get around mandatory insurance coverage for contraception, which is required under the ACA. And, you know, they quickly condemned this effort, said, you know, it was just trying to pander to voters and hide Senator Ayotte's record. She's voted a couple of times to defund Planned Parenthood. But, you know, her campaign has countered that, you know, she's serious about making contraception easily accessible. And I guess it's up for voters to decide how they feel.
All right. We'll continue this in a moment. Coming up more on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup in just a minute on NHPR. Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Allie Morris of the Concord Monitor, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University. I want to continue our discussion of Kelly Ayotte's outreach via condom for a moment. And, you know, obviously a general election strategy. I mean, I have to say that, this is something that not all conservative Republicans are happy with, are they, Trent?
That's a great point. Not all conservative Republicans are happy. Like I said, she needs to try and build a coalition. And I think part of this idea was, let's see if we can win over some college students at UNH. But the problem is it really did blow up on social media. And so a lot of conservatives who may not have seen this did see it. There was a lot of news coverage about it. And conservatives were upset. I heard from one Republican who said, you know, look, I spend a lot of money to send my kid to UNH, and I don't exactly want my United States senator handing out condoms there. I just don't think that that's an appropriate thing. And you have to think back to kind of the New Hampshire mentality. People are they don't want to talk about things like this as much. So, you know, I did hear from a lot of conservative Republicans who were upset, and I wonder how many more moderate Republicans they won over on campus by doing this event.
Well, I mean, the campaign even had a Snapchat geofilter, which said, you know, I got a free condom. Thanks, Kelly Ayotte. So that's obviously, you know, reaching out to the young folks. I mean, probably not that many sort of rock-ribbed conservatives are Snapchat users, not to stereotype. But so, you know, we'll see. I mean, but your point is well taken, Trent, in terms of trying to kind of compartmentalize your outreach efforts. I mean, the media attention this got certainly undercut that effort, assuming it was afoot.
Yeah, and this wasn't a mistake. This was a well-planned out thing where they did go, you know, they went out of their way to develop the Snapchat filter. They had been doing this for a week. And I just don't think that they were planning for the reaction that would come after this spread more widely.
All right. Let us know what you think. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or, of course, on Facebook or Twitter. Why don't we move to the governor's race? There was a big debate there that this week as well. Dean, what were your impressions?
I thought it was an interesting debate. First time I've had a chance to sort of see the two of them engage side by side. It was interesting because they, you know, they've been sitting together on the executive council for a number of years now. So there was this kind of familiarity and back and forth between the two of them. You know, I mean, you saw some interesting differences in style. Colin Van Ostern is sort of kind of data oriented and sort of, kind of very sort of a little bit policy wonky at times. And Chris Sununu sometimes comes across as sort of more of kind of a politician who likes to connect on an emotional level. So it's sort of slightly different stylistically. But there were, you know, a lot of the issues that I expected to be highlighted were highlighted. All the controversy over Sununu's Planned Parenthood contract funding votes, Colin Van Ostern's focus on rail, which is a big issue for him. And we know that Sununu said that would be a $300 million boondoggle. They talked about education. They argued over Medicaid expansion, whether to make it permanent or not. So I thought it was a good opportunity for people who are not familiar with these two men to kind of see what some of the differences are, both in stylistically and temperament, and also in terms of policy. And then the final thing I'll say is there was a sort of interesting debate over, you know, who is the true business leader. You know, Sununu went after Van Ostern, saying he's really a political operative with only a few years of business experience, that he's kind of blowing up his business experience beyond what it really is. And Van Ostern in turn pointed to Sununu and said, you know, you're driving Waterville Valley into the ground, and it's not just the snow. There's other issues at work for why it's not succeeding.
Well, why don't we listen to what Chris Sununu said about Colin Van Ostern in this debate over, you know, kind of resumes, basically.
You know, when he was a spokesperson and working on the John Edwards campaign in 2004, I was cleaning up asbestos landfills in downtown Nashua. When he was running Annie Custer's campaign, I was working, putting together a program to bring Waterville back into local hands and managing what I think is one of New Hampshire's most storied assets and businesses.
That was Chris Sununu during this week's gubernatorial debate. And you hear him there making a case that, you know, Republicans, you know, kind of came out of the box after the primary was over. It was pretty clear that this was one line of attack they were going to be launching at Colin Van Ostern, is that despite his kind of branding as business leader, you know, he's best known in the state as a political operative and a fairly effective one in Democratic campaigns for some years.
That's right. I mean, his business history is a little murky. He worked for, you know, people who are happy to help other Democrats. And so we don't have much information about what he really did at Stonyfield and at Southern New Hampshire University. The other problem with this race is that there's so much coverage of the Senate race, which will probably end up costing more than $100 million, and the presidential race, that both Colin Van Ostern and Chris Sununu are having a real difficulty getting their message out. We've seen Sununu spending a lot of time fundraising lately. And from what I've heard, it's been difficult to fundraise for this race. So he hasn't done many events. Colin Van Ostern has done a number of events, policy rollouts and
campaign is running at a kind of, I mean, I guess you could call it a higher metabolism in terms of, you know, getting whatever message du jour out to the public.
That's right. But not that many people are paying attention to the race as much as the campaign. And Colin, as you mentioned, was an operative. So he understands how to run a campaign and he understands how to create these events and talk about the message of the day. But the problem is, if you're talking about a message of the day, whether it's education or Medicaid expansion or the heroin epidemic, it if no one's paying attention to it, doesn't really matter.
Yeah. I mean, Chris Sununu obviously grew up around politics as well. So why don't we listen to his sort of rejoinder to or why don't we listen to Colin Van Ostern's rejoinder about his business record, what he said about Chris Sununu in Waterville Valley.
Chris's family bought that ski mountain and he became CEO. Skier visits have fallen in half. Now, I know we've had some rough winters, but look at Loon, one of its competitors. They've dropped by less than 10%. Waterville has fallen from, I think it was 12th or 13th in the rankings for Ski East to 15th to 17th to 20th this year, actually got dropped off the list.
All right. That was Colin Van Ostern with an assessment of Chris Sununu's performance managing Waterville Valley. You know, is there any indication that this is something that, you know, as voters size these guys up, who they still don't know terribly well, the average voter, that this sort of line of attack or this sort of debate, rather than, you know, where do you stand on policy X, Y, and Z, is going to drive people's decisions, Allie?
I mean, personally, I think it's particularly interesting because both of these men are relatively young. I mean, Colin is 37, Chris is 41, and they both come from the same body, which is the Executive Council, which I don't think most people in the state are super familiar with. They approve contracts and vote on nominations, so they're not especially part of the lawmaking and legislative process. And so when they go back and forth about their records on the Executive Council, you know, they bring up Planned Parenthood and Medicaid expansion, but they haven't had much work in actually crafting bills. And so to me, I think the business experience is one area where they can differentiate themselves from the other. And I think that is interesting to voters. I mean, both men are promising to boost the economy. That's basically the message of their campaigns. Chris Sununu has said he wants to do that by cutting taxes, and Colin has said he wants to make investments in education and rail. And I think that looking at their business backgrounds is a way that you can, you know, kind of judge how they've done on that front.
Tell us what you think. Join us if you've got any comments on the governor's race. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. So were there any other sort of definitional moments in this debate for you? I mean, I thought it was interesting, you know, when they're talking about drugs that, you know, Van Ostern is quick to tout, you know, his Facebook endorsement by Manchester Police Chief Nick Willard, who obviously clashed a bit with Sununu during the primary. You know, the polls show this race tight. You know, is this all going to be captured to the top of the ticket, I guess, is what I'm wondering.
I think it's certainly more likely to be the case than if this were a midterm election. I think you'd see a very kind of different level of focus. I think Trent's right. There's just not a lot of room in terms of the political coverage for these guys to get their messages out there. You know, for me, there weren't any sort of big surprises, although I thought that I agree with Allie. I thought that the sort of competitive framing of each other's resumes was very interesting, and I think it's something that provides a context and the ability of each of these individuals to undercut the narrative that the other wants to present to the public. So, you know, but in terms of kind of the kinds of issues and sort of Planned Parenthood and rail and all that and education, you know, I've been following them for a long time, so I guess because I was familiar with a lot of where they are on a lot of these issues. You know, nothing really surprised me, but I think for somebody tuning in and trying to learn about them, I think it was a pretty useful look at sort of temperament, issue focus, and the kinds of things you might need to make up a decision. So I think it was, a helpful debate.
I mean, if you were tuning in, I mean, I guess one thing that crossed my mind is that you might wonder if Councillor Sununu was running against Governor Hassan. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was in
vote, true, a lot of Hassan. Yep.
Numerous times, and you know, maybe that's a shorthand way of indicting, you know, the status quo,
sure.
But that was striking to me.
Yeah, and just going back to your previous point about Nick Willard, and both the Manchester police chief and Colin Van Ostern were clear that he wasn't endorsing in his official position as the Manchester police chief, that he was endorsing as Nick Willard.
It's good to be clear about those things.
Exactly. So, but that was very interesting. We've seen the Manchester police chief take on an increased role in this campaign. As you mentioned, he did have a Twitter spat with Chris Sununu early in the race, right as Chris was filing his paperwork. When Chris filed his paperwork, he said there's been no local leadership on the opioid epidemic, and the Manchester police chief took that to mean you know, the Manchester Police Department, the Manchester Fire Department, which clearly have done a lot on this.
Well, why don't we take a listen to what Chris Sununu said on the Governor Hassan front when he brought her up in the context of Planned Parenthood and explaining what a vote that, you know, is probably the issue he's had to wrestle with the most. I believe that's cut 3.
And I said, Governor,
I've been very supportive of this. Provide us some more information. Let's clear up the issue. We could probably do it in a couple weeks. Let's clear up the issue, make sure Planned Parenthood in Northern New England has nothing to do with that, which I never have believed that they had. She refused. She refused to simply look into it and provide more information. Well, our job at the Executive Council is checks and balances. It's accountability. And when the governor isn't willing to be accountable, well, we have to say no to that.
All right, that was Chris Sununu talking about his vote against a contract with Planned Parenthood. He subsequently voted for a more recent contract with the state with Planned Parenthood. So, Ali, you obviously covered this whole thing. Do you believe that Chris Sununu, when he says, "Oh, we could have had this cleared up in 2 weeks," that a delay, I don't recall that is necessarily what people presumed at the time.
No, I don't think that was what people presumed at the time. I think, you know, when this contract came up in 2015, it was right when there were investigations across the country. Congress was really taking a look at Planned Parenthood funding. And if you recall, that was when they were taking a lot of votes to try to defund the organization and then eventually put it into a short-term funding bill and threatened to shut down the government over Planned Parenthood funding. So this was in the midst of a huge national dialogue about this topic. And I don't remember there being any kind of call to swiftly resolve this. It was more playing into the national narrative. But I think what's interesting, too, what you mentioned about how I was surprised that Chris Sununu was attacking Governor Hassan so much. I think he was probably trying to tie Colin to Governor Hassan, but he didn't really communicate that in the debate. So it seemed like he was debating two people on the stage, Governor Hassan and Colin, without really making the case that Colin would be a Maggie Hassan 2.0.
Yes. It's interesting. And, you know, I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, Hassan's polling reasonably well right now. I mean, I guess it's sort of, you know, pick your route. You're trying to appeal to partisans. But I'm not sure what you get other than, again, he's running he's running on a kind of restorationist model of like we need to move the state back to when leadership was strong and, you know, we didn't kowtow to demands from Washington. I mean, that seemed to be what he was summoning on, you know, multiple fronts. I guess we'll see what voters make.
And I think the argument he made was maybe a little too complicated. Look, he supported the Planned Parenthood contract. He supported it for several years before he voted against it, and then he supported it after he voted against it. And what I've heard earlier, what the explanation he's used earlier is, look, when I'm on the Executive Council, I don't vote for contracts if the contractor is under investigation. Simple. That was a pretty simple argument. They were under investigation. I wanted to see what the outcome of the investigation was, which is why I voted against it. This idea of trying to tie Maggie Hassan to Colin Van Ostern, and I think it's just maybe a little too complicated. I think it's a pretty – he had a simple explanation at the time, and so I'm not sure why he's adding to it now.
So do tell us what you think. If you've got comments on the governor's race, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter. And let's go to the phones. We have Amy on the line from Sugar Hill.
Hi. I wanted to address one of the questions put forth by one of the panelists about Kelly Ayotte's response to the question by Chris Ryan and the fact that this was a hard question and that she should have answered it differently. I think that it was very revealing, her answer, and that this is what journalists are supposed to do. They should be asking hard questions, and that she answered in such a way that showed a real sense of amorphous, a kind of vague values, and that these are answers we should listen to. And it's not that she should have reframed it as though, you know, this is some kind of political response that, you know, would have made her look better. This is not about how Kelly Ayotte should look better. It's about how she responds to a hard question.
So how would you have preferred her to respond?
Well, it's not my preference, but I think honestly. I think she should respond with honesty, and it didn't come through as an honest response. So she should be honest about her response. I don't know exactly what her response would be, but it certainly didn't sound like an honest response. And for other people to then say how she should respond, to make it look more politically correct for her or politically accurate as opposed to what she honestly feels is not helpful, or it actually is extremely helpful because it shows that she is really willing to answer politically are very careful about how to answer a very important question.
I mean, does how she answered change your perspective on her in any way?
Well, it actually confirmed my perspective about Kelly Ayotte, that I think that she fudges a lot, and I don't think that she does. I think that she tries to blur lines, and that we can't always see how she stands on issues. And then when she comes out with an ad where she says she's going to stand up for New Hampshire, I think that those kinds of answers reflect the fact that she wouldn't necessarily even stand up for views. I would respect her about her views that I disagree with more.
All right, Amy, thank you. Got it. Thank you for calling. Point well made. You know, certainly the Hassan campaign hopes there are a lot of people coming away from that interlude with Amy's set of concerns. You know, again, we'll see. Do call. Let us know what you think. 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter. This is the New Hampshire Weekly News Roundup. Our guests are Allie Morris of the Concord Monitor, Trent Spinner, New Hampshire Union leader, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Do call 1-800-892-6477. So I guess we'll see if the half-life of the role model issue persists. Lord knows how many advertising dollars are going to be spent, hammering home that word absolutely. I was just trying to think of a moment in another New Hampshire political race where one word, stuck. I mean, who knows, in our kind of, ruthlessly sort of forgetting sort of viral culture, how long this does last. But, it's an open question. You know, coming up after the break, there'll be more of New Hampshire's top Granite State headlines in our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, and I promise we will move from politics in a moment or two. 1-800-892-6477 is the number to call. This is New Hampshire Weekly News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter. And we do have a call in line. Why don't we go to Arthur, who's calling from Epsom. Good morning, Arthur. Good morning, Arthur.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
Yeah, I think it was last week that I started noticing a national security ad from Kelly Ayotte that went after Hassan on her inexperience. And just last night, I saw a Hassan ad on TV defending her national security positions. Obviously, this is an important issue, but I am curious to get the panel's take on Hassan going on defense on the issue of national security.
All right. Thank you, Arthur. You know, national security has been an area where Kelly Ayotte, by dint of her experience on the Foreign Relations Committee and time in Washington, believes that this is an advantage. And oftentimes, polling would indicate that Republicans enjoy an edge with some voters on national security issues. You know, Dean, this race hasn't really been fought on those grounds too much. And, Governor Hassan's done a reasonably good job of sort of shrinking differences to the extent they're there.
Yeah, and it is something, just speaking more generally, it is something that is often a challenge for governors who then decide to run for Senate because, governors don't have a lot of foreign policy experience. They typically fall back on talking about their trade missions. That's how they kind of talk about their experience. And Kelly Ayotte, having spent time in the Senate already and kind of becoming known for her work on foreign policy with Lindsey Graham and John McCain, she's on a couple of committees in the Senate that focus on foreign policy and security issues. So I think they view it as she has a little bit of a kind of a built-in advantage there in terms of experience. Maggie Hassan initially sort of wasn't too focused on it, got some criticism, has sort of schooled herself a little bit on it. But you're right, it hasn't been the sort of huge issue that it sometimes is. And like you said, she has sort of had some success at kind of minimizing the differences in terms of strategy. And she's gone out of her way on things like the Syrian refugees, Guantanamo Bay, to put a little daylight between herself and Clinton and Obama.
The Hassan campaign is on the defense in terms of national security, defense, and everything like that, because the Ayotte campaign has been on the offense about it. Like Dean mentions, you know, she's focused a lot of her time in the Senate on these issues. And so what they're trying to do, what the Ayotte campaign is trying to do, is portray Hassan as weak or maybe not as knowledgeable as Ayotte on some of these issues. They have been pushing for a debate on this very topic. And with these stories about who's debating and where they're debating, it's always difficult to really know what's happening behind the scenes because you don't know what the schedules are like and what the criteria is. You don't know really what's going on behind the scenes. But the Ayotte campaign has been pushing for a debate on foreign matters, national security, and the Hassan campaign has not agreed to this debate. So the Ayotte campaign has made this a real issue. And so that's why I think we're seeing Hassan on the defense about it.
Well, you do wonder if Ayotte might have had theoretically a stronger hand on this front if Donald Trump weren't the Republican nominee, if it were somebody who was running whose foreign policy credentials were clearer than Donald Trump. Obviously, a lot of members of the GOP foreign policy establishment have kind of jumped ship and are backing Hillary Clinton. And, you know, maybe if they're a different kind of nominee, it would be easier for Ayotte to make this case against Hassan.
Yeah. And that's – you just outlined one of the main attack lines that Hassan does use on this topic. And I think Dean is right. You know, Hassan has said that she disagrees with President Obama on his plan to close Guantanamo Bay, which was a major attack point that Kelly Ayotte has used against the president and at first against Governor Hassan until she came out with this position. And now I think the biggest difference between the two and one that Kelly Ayotte regularly brings up is that she opposes the Iran nuclear deal, while Hassan calls it an imperfect agreement, but one that she thinks will keep nuclear weapons out of the hands of the Iranians.
All right. Thanks again, Arthur, for your call. Join us 1-800-892-6477, email at exchange@nhpr.org. Let's shift away from electoral politics for a minute at least. And I do want to touch on an investigation by the Attorney General's office that was released a week ago today. And that was a look at former State Rep Kyle Tasker's drug activities in and around the State House. Kyle Tasker, Representative Nottingham, resigned, amid charges for trying to lure an underage girl into sex on the internet. And then he also was, dealing drugs, and drugs were found in his house, say the state police. And so this report came out, and it implicated five reps in Kyle Tasker's marijuana use and sales in and around the state house. This is obviously something your papers looked at pretty closely, Trent.
That's right. And it really answers the question that I think a lot of people ask when they see stuff coming out of Concord: what are they smoking up there? Now we know the answer. What the report showed was that some state reps were smoking in the state house, but it also showed that some of them actually had heartbreaking stories. There was one military veteran from Manchester who suffers from PTSD and several other issues. He said he was addicted to opioids because he had a chronic pain, and that smoking marijuana got him off of opioids. We had another state rep whose wife was dying of cancer. And the only way she could stay, he says, the only way that she could stay in this experimental chemo treatment was to smoke marijuana for the pain. And so I think that what this has done, besides all the lurid details of Kyle Tasker and what he was doing and, everything that was illegal about this, I think it has really focused on it's kind of shed some light on the effort within the state house from some of the state reps who are really focused on either legalizing or decriminalizing marijuana in the state. And it highlighted some of their stories.
Well, and some of the names that surface in this are names very familiar to those who followed, medical marijuana and efforts of decriminalization, Allie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think just one thing to note quickly is that while this report came out detailing some of these illicit activities, none of the representatives are actually being charged with anything, which I think took some of them and others by surprise. I think some of them were surprised to see such personal detail about them revealed in a report where they weren't actually facing any criminal charges. charges. But yeah, you're correct. A lot of these people, Representative Joe LaChance, he has been a big advocate for medical marijuana and making sure everyone who might need this drug to ease their pain is able to get it.
Well, he in fact sued to hasten the program.
Exactly. Yeah, and he was one of those who I talked to who said, you know, it took a couple years for the state's medicinal marijuana program to actually get up and running, and for these alternative treatment centers to actually begin selling products. And so in the interim, he said, you know, he had no other option but to buy marijuana illegally because, as Trent mentioned, you know, he needed to ease his pain somehow.
And then, you know, he also was the originator of a kind of big pull quote from the report, which was that Kyle Tasker was, quote, like the Club Med of pot. You know, it is this report was interesting for another reason, though, the scope of it. I mean, they say they've collected 60,000 pages, which struck me as an awful lot. And I talked to someone who has prosecuted homicides in the attorney general's office, and they told me a typical homicide case might generate 5,000 or 6,000 pages. So, you know, we're talking about a report that, you know, arguably was equal to 10 murders in terms of the amount of work that went into at least, you know, pawing through documents pulled from, you know, Kyle Tasker's computer and, you know, God knows what else.
That's right. And there were rumors, I don't know if you remember, or last summer, there were rumors that Kyle Tasker had this black book or this list and that it included all kinds of other people, including state senators and everything like that. And that turned out not to be true. He wasn't keeping a list. What the attorney general's office did was they went through all of his PayPal transactions, his credit card transactions. They got a warrant. They went through his Facebook messages, and they were able to compile their own list of people that he conducted business with. And so, you know, good on the AG's office here, because we would have been able to get most of these records through the right to know law. We would have, and I can tell you that the union leader would have absolutely done that. Were the names not included, we would have absolutely filed a right to know request. We would have gone through all 60,000 pages. And so I think it's good on the AG's office that they went out, they took the initiative to put this together in one report. You can read it on our website, unionleader.com. And it really just laid out what happened here and why they chose not to charge any of these people. And just to, you know, just the quick reason is that the state reps who talked to the AG's office about Kyle Tasker basically got deals where they wouldn't be prosecuted for whatever they told the AG's office as long as it was true. And so they took those deals. They went in with attorneys and they said, look, here were my interactions with Kyle Tasker. And they weren't charged for that.
All right. So no charges out of this report. But, you know, I did think it was telling to the degree to which the debate over marijuana and medical and otherwise has become sort of, you know, I guess you could call it sort of more normalized at the State House. I mean, this is always a very fraught topic. You know, regardless of who wins the governor's race, they're both open to decriminalization. Allie, there's certainly going to be more bills filed, both on the medical marijuana front and in terms of decriminalization, legalization. You know, I would expect this debate to be one that we're going to get at length.
Yeah, definitely. And I think depending on how much turnover we see in the House, and, you know, the Senate has always been kind of the block for any reform to the marijuana law. The House has passed several bills to legalize the drug, to decriminalize it, and those have always stalled in the state Senate. And I think, you know, we're seeing huge turnover in the state Senate this year. There are 6 senators who will not be returning to the chamber for various reasons. And some of them include pretty vocal actually opponents to marijuana. You see Senator Jeanie Forrester, who ran for governor. She is very against decriminalizing the drug or legalizing it. And so we'll see, you know, if she is replaced and maybe others with people more open to this, then it could get a shot.
Well, it is interesting. Senate. I mean, it does seem that this is a sort of a generational issue, if not literally one, but in terms of, like, if you've been in Concord for a while, you probably have a position that is adverse to decriminalization or legalization, at least at the state Senate level. I also think it's telling that this is an issue in which the police lobby you know, may have other irons in the fire, but they've kind of lost ground on this. And, you know, for years, the Democrats in the corner office didn't want to appear soft on crime as well. And, you know, Governor Hassan was obviously a significant roadblock to changes to marijuana laws, medical and otherwise. So this will be interesting to see where this
goes. Putting aside decriminalization and legalization for the moment, you know, I think this episode raises what was a debate back when they were first deciding on whether or not to allow medical marijuana, and that's the narrowness of the list of conditions in New Hampshire for which you can qualify for a medical marijuana card. PTSD is not one of them that is included, whereas in other states, things like PTSD, anxiety, other kinds of chronic pain are included, not in New Hampshire. So, you know, even if there's no progress for people who support decrim or legalization, maybe this will re-engage the debate over the medical conditions covered by the medical law.
All right. So what's everyone going to be up to next week? We're kind of running out of time here. Trent, what are you going to be just kind of walking the decks over there with the union leader?
This Sunday, we're going to have an interesting piece. If you've been listening to the show, you're probably interested in politics. We're going to have a big takeout on the State House Dome and everything that's been going on with the renovations, almost a $3 million renovation. It's almost done. We're going to have a full story about it. It'll be really interesting and some great pictures.
I've never been up there. I've always wanted to go. Allie, what about you?
I'll be doing some more election coverage, looking into campaign finance and who are these super PACs that are putting up all these ads that you're seeing every day.
Who are they, Dean?
That'll be interesting. Just all campaign all the time. Got more debates coming up, lots to focus on.
All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Have a good Columbus Day weekend. This is NHPR's weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Josh Rogers.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.